Good afternoon. So my name is Jason Juhich. I was just reminiscing a couple minutes ago. You know, it was almost 10 years ago now that I was actually in this class. So I actually started out here as, I don't know how many of you are master's students. I started out here at Roswell Park as a master's student, and then joined the PhD program and did my postdoc here, and now I'm assistant professor, Department of Urology. I went to Sweet Home High School, so I'm born, bred, and from Buffalo. So the focus of my work really is on immunotherapy and how to really optimize these immunotherapeutic protocols for cancer treatment. There's a lot of recent excitement about these agents to kind of bolster the body's immune response to cancer. So full disclosure, our laboratory does receive some funding from Dendrion and Argos, which are two companies that are really supporting these dendritic cell vaccine strategies I'm going to talk to you about today. Okay, so the reason I think there's so much interest in harnessing the anti-tumor immune responses is the ability to generate these profound responses and really manage disease that otherwise can't be handled by surgery or conventional methods. And there's a lot of, again, recent interest. You've heard of checkpoint blockade strategies probably and these other agents. But going back now 30 years, we've known that there's this potential, this possibility, and this was shown by Steve Rosenberg's group, again, 30 years ago. So this is a patient with metastatic kidney cancer, and their liver, you know, half their liver is taken up by this tumor. And they're treated with just high-dose IL-2, just this high-dose level of cytokine treatment. And afterwards, there's no metastatic burden, and this patient had a complete response, meaning before this treatment, they had not only primary disease, but malignancies at other sites in this patient in their liver. And afterwards, there's no detectable disease. And importantly, with this treatment, again, going back decades now, there's a subset of patients that have these responses. And when a patient has a complete response to immunotherapy, most likely this disease, even a decade later, is not observable. So this kind of effect isn't short-term. It's something that is sustained in these patients. And to date, kidney cancer, renal cell carcinoma, kidney cancer, and skin cancer, melanoma, have been the most responsive to these conventional cytokine immune therapies. And they're also obviously responsive to the more recent adoptive transfer and checkpoint blockade strategies. But in order for anti-tumor immunity to really have to be effective, a number of prerequisites have to be met. And this is what I want you all to focus on today. You know, we think of these different targeted therapies, you know, whatever researcher, you know, you're performing, it's usually not one molecular target that is going to solve the problem. The tumor is very heterogeneous. And in terms of the anti-tumor immune response, it's almost similar. You need to target multiple steps here, multiple requirements. So I'm going to try to go through this slowly, and if there's any questions, please let me know now, because this is kind of fundamental. So T cells, which are really your effector cells in this scenario, they're the cells that are going to kill the tumor. They have to recognize tumor antigens, peptides that are presented by the tumor, and they're presented by dendritic cells in lymph nodes. So T cells that are specific for any one antigen in your body and my body, they're at the frequency of about 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 1 million, okay? And a dendritic cell, this guy that has dendrites, these long arms, okay, they're going to position themselves right by these vascular entry sites in lymph nodes called high endothelial venules, or HEVs. That's not in the test. Don't worry about the actual name. But the important part is the dendritic cells position themselves so that this very rare event, when they come into contact with that antigen-specific T cell, is productive. They're trying to increase the frequency of these efficient contacts. T cells have to become activated when they come into contact with dendritic cells. So this T cell that started off as 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1 million, has to multiply and form an effector T cell pool. It starts off as a naive T cell. It has to become activated and multiply, expand to form an effector T cell pool that is capable of destroying the tumor target. Okay? Oop. And another important part of this process is it does no good if there's activation and proliferation against this target. But the T cells also have to infiltrate into the tumor microenvironment. They have to reach their target destination. There's no remote control mechanism by which the T cell can kill the tumor. It has to physically contact the tumor in order to kill it. So the T cells multiply and expand in the lymph nodes. They re-enter circulation as effector CD8 T cells, and hopefully they're able to gain access to the tumor microenvironment. And here, there's additional issues in terms of the anti-tumor immune response. The T cell then has to actually lyse tumor targets, and the tumor can mask itself by not presenting the antigen. There's additional checkpoints that have to be met in order, prerequisites that have to be met in order for the T cell to kill it, even after it's reached the tumor microenvironment. And we'll talk a little bit more about those in a few minutes. So any questions on this slide? Because I think this is important. Okay. Now, I initially introduced IL-2 therapy, and I kind of wanted to give a very brief introduction to how this is performed, because it's still something that's approved for metastatic renal cell carcinoma. I still think it has a role in terms of patient management. So IL-2 treatment, patients undergo cycles where they're treated with these very high levels of IL-2 for 8 hours, for 5 days. And then there's a 10-day break where there's no treatment. And then they're back on a second cycle of IL-2 for another 5 days. This treatment has so many side effects associated with it that early on patients could die from the side effects of just this treatment alone. During this initial treatment strategy, it's important to monitor patients and see if they can handle the side effects associated with it. And now we've become much better in terms of managing the delivery of this treatment, and there's very few situations like that. And then there's a recovery period for about 4 weeks, and then at this point, the clinicians and the patients decide whether or not to continue treatment. And to put into some context in terms of how patients respond to this therapy, I wanted to show this therapy, IL-2, that's been around again for 30 years in comparison to these tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have been more recent strategies to target metastatic kidney cancer. So there is some benefit here in terms of when you compare it to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These aren't the same group of patients, so it's not matched up perfectly. IL-2 is and the tyrosine kinase inhibitors are very similar in terms of the objective response rates, but IL-2 by far has the greatest level of cytotoxicity in patient management. And experts in the field that still deliver this therapy, they mention in conversations how difficult this can be on the patients. But in terms of the complete responses, in terms of that ability to not only target the primary tumor, but to eradicate tumor not only, as well as the malignant sites, metastatic sites, IL-2 is still superior to these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. It's almost 10% of patients will have these types of responses. So more recently, what's come into the field more recently from IL-2 are these checkpoint blockade strategies. There's been a lot of recent excitement. In 2013, Science Magazine, immunotherapy is the breakthrough of the year. And this is largely in the backs of these drugs that are available off the shelf. Anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1, and anti-PD-L1. And I'm just going to introduce these briefly. I know that you'll probably receive more information on them in this course as well. and I'll also hit upon a vaccination approach that we're very interested in our laboratory. So first, let's talk about CTLA-4. So in order for a T cell to become activated, that process that I was detailing in the lymph nodes, right? There's multiple signals. There's multiple signals. There's multiple prerequisites. So the T cell receptor, again, this is the part that's specific. There's 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1 million, this event that's specific for this antigen. Okay, we have to have the T cell receptor come into contact with antigen presented in the context of MHC. We also have to have co-stimulation that's provided by CD80, CD86, and CD28. There's an additional cytokine requirement, but let's just focus on these two for now. CTLA-4, present on T cells, can block the second response and kind of inhibit T cell activation. So what this therapy, anti-CTLA-4 or IPI does is it blocks this pathway, so T cell activation is a little bit more efficient. It's been approved as a first-line or second-line treatment for advanced melanoma. Importantly, it can enhance survival, including there's some durable responses greater than 2.5 years in a substantial portion of these patients. One thing that was noted initially in these trials is that responses can be delayed. So there are side effects associated with treatment with this therapy, but it's important that some of these patients continue treatment because the response, even though it was initially shown, can happen later on in treatment. Okay, so we've kind of covered this portion, T cell activation, in terms of checkpoint blockade strategies. But again, we have to keep in mind that there's a completely separate portion of this anti-tumor immune response that's taking place in the tumor microenvironment. And so here's where PD-1 and PD-L1 come into play. So in terms of anti-PD-1, what it's really targeting is this effect that the tumor can have by expressing PD-L1 and binding to PD-1 in the T cell that really shuts down the T cell response. So it's an antibody blockade of PD-1 that we think of mostly occurring on the T cell, or PD-L1 on the tumor cell. And this is still, you know, we're still finding that PD-L1 can be expressed on the T cell. They're calling it here PD-1L, but we think of it as PD-L1. So it doesn't necessarily always occur by just binding PD-L1 on the tumor cell. It can also bind PD-L1 on the T cell. And when we put this in the context of IL-2, what we see is there's similar objective response rates, right? And PD-1 kind of has the best as a standalone agent. But these guys, specifically PD-L1 and PD-1, aren't associated with the same level of toxicity as we see with IL-2 treatment. And again, what we really want to focus on is complete responses sometimes. And PD-1 as a signal agent we're almost seeing the similar rates as we see with IL-2. What's important to note, again, is that most of our complete responders, they'll still have no observable disease 2 years after their last treatment. So the clinician gives this immunotherapeutic agent, and then if you have this type of response, it's a situation where the patient can go off treatment, and we can just monitor them. So in terms of the field, I think where we're moving now is these standalone agents, whether we're talking about checkpoint blockade strategies, we're talking about conventional treatment with high-dose IL-2, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we're seeing the same kind of percentages of responses in patients. About a 20% objective response rate when we combine the complete responders and the partial responders. And most of the patients aren't having an observable decrease in tumor volume. And the questions are really similar in terms of these different treatments, okay? How can we improve upon this just 20 to 30% objective response rate? And is there any way that we can identify patients that will have these responses prior to therapy? Is there anything we can do to enrich the patients that have that will respond to therapy? Again, one thing that we could do is instead of focusing on one step, on one of these prerequisites, we could target both of them simultaneously. So we think of anti-CTLA-4 as targeting the T-cell activation step, and we think of anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 as targeting the T-cell function within the tumor microenvironment. So perhaps combining both of those therapeutic modalities could have a greater benefit to the patient. You're not only improving activation, you're improving T-cell function and lymph node and their ability to multiply and expand there, but you're also improving the ability of these T-cells to function once they get in that very, and there's many other immunosuppressive effects in the tumor microenvironment, but you, by targeting this PD-1, PD-L1 axis, you can improve the T-cell function there and potentially improve T-cell killing in the tumor microenvironment. And this is this was published a few years ago by Jed Welchok's group. So a clinical trial that combined CTLA-4 and PD-1 for melanoma treatment. Here we can see patient responses to combined treatment. And again, when we started, we were talking about patient responses that were usually around 20 to 30% objective responses. And these are, again, metastatic patients. So advanced disease Here we're seeing patient responses hovering around 50% when we're combining PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4. So I think this is where we're going, combining treatments to really stack the deck in favor of an anti-tumor immune response. Again, I'm not there's not that many complete responders, and these are kind of the ones that stand out in the group, the patients that have these profound responses where they have metastatic disease and afterwards it's undetectable. But in some instances, it is occurring. So finally, let's talk about dendritic cell vaccines because that's something that's near and dear to my heart. So there's a number of different ways, and the dendritic cells, again, are these cells that really activate T cells and they initiate these anti-tumor immune responses. And there's a number of different ways that we can drive dendritic cells to have these to initiate these anti-tumor responses. Endogenous vaccination, so there's a possibility you could use radiotherapy or chemotherapy to kill a large portion of that tumor that'll just be picked up by your dendritic cells, by a patient's dendritic cells, and activate the tumor specific T cells. You can target dendritic cells specifically using different agents that'll bind to the dendritic cell and induce an anti-tumor immune response. You can target antigens with antibodies that are specific for dendritic cells and inject them into patients. But what we're really going to focus on today is ex vivo generation of dendritic cells. So harvesting material from patients and then growing that up into a product that is a mature dendritic cell and injecting that to initiate an anti-tumor immune response. So here's the, when most people think of a dendritic cell vaccine, they think of SIPT or Provenge that was approved for prostate cancer a few years ago. And this product is generated from patients' blood monocytes that are cultured in vitro into dendritic cells. And they're pulsed with this this tumor-associated antigen, PAP, that's also fused to GM-CSF. So this is a dendritic cell vaccine that is really presenting the PAP peptide to induce a PAP-specific T-cell response. This DC is then injected into the patient, and the idea is to elicit T-cell proliferation that can then go ahead and attack the tumor. But what I want to focus on is it's against a single antigen. What was found using this therapy is that there's about an overall 4-month prolonged median benefit And there's very few objective biological responses with CIFT. But it is FDA approved. It's something that can be used in the clinic. And here's the Kaplan-Meier showing you that there's very minimal benefit in terms of this therapy. I think, you know, the weakness of this approach is that it's against one antigen. So tumors are heterogeneous. You know, if you target one antigen, you know, if you have a very effective response, still that the rest of the tumor will devise a way to get around that. Okay, so there's other methods of producing a dendritic cell that can give you that can target multiple antigens in the body, and this is one of them. So this is the Argos approach. So in this approach, what's done is peripheral blood is taken from the patient and purified into monocytes that are then cultured ex vivo. This is all performed at Argos facility, and then electroporated with tumor RNA that was taken from a resected tumor, along with CD40 ligand to provide an additional stimulus for these dendritic cells. The product's then injected intradermally every week for 4 weeks, so there's 4 injections. And when combined with sunitinib, Sutent, we can see about a 43 partial response rate. They don't see complete responses to this therapy, but a 43% partial response rate in metastatic patients with kidney cancer. Median objective survival, 30.2 months, and most often when we think of these patients, they have a median survival about 16 months. So this combination of TKI inhibitor with a dendritic cell vaccine seems to be having an effect. And I also wanted to point out that there's a very exciting trial that Dr. Schwab has going on here at Roswell Park. And this is, it's an ongoing trial for localized kidney cancer. And in this trial, the Argos product is injected into patients with a localized tumor. So needle biopsies performed to generate the vaccine. Dr. Schwab will give intradermal injections of this vaccine, and then 6 weeks later, the tumor is resected. So this is something that's still being explored. And the Argos product is also in phase 3 trial with sunitinib. Okay, so what about combining dendritic cell vaccination with conventional therapy like high-dose IL-2? This was a very interesting trial that was performed by Dr. Schwab and now the new chair of medicine here at Roswell Park, Dr. Mark Ernstoff at Dartmouth. In this scenario, again, the startup's the same. We use monocytes as our starting material. We culture ex vivo into dendritic cells. But this part's a little different. Instead of using whole tumor RNA, we're using the resected kidney tumor and pulsing with autologous tumor cell lysate from that resection, these dendritic cells. So, and that, again, the importance there is there's many, these dendritic cells are presumably presenting all these antigens from the tumor, not just one. The dendritic cells in this scenario were injected directly into the patient's lymph node, so they weren't injected intradermally. You're putting them right where they need to go to activate activate T cells. And we're also supplementing here with IL-2 and interferon alpha. Interferon alpha hasn't really shown much promise in the clinic, but IL-2, obviously, I've shown you some data that a subset of patients can have pretty profound responses. In this clinical trial, and albeit there was only 18 patients, there was a 50% objective response rate. These are, again, metastatic patients, about a median survival of about 16 months. So 3 patients had complete responses, and they had pretty extensive disease. These patients, some of them had lymph node mets, lung mets, bone mets, and a 33% at 6 patients had a partial response. This trial was completed almost 10 years ago. 5 of these 18 patients are still alive. So it seemed to have a profound effect. Not all of them were the complete responders, obviously. Any questions up to this point? Everyone still with me? Maybe? Okay. You sure? Okay. So again, I think I've provided an initial answer on what we can do to improve our response rates. We could combine different immunotherapies like dendritic cell vaccines and conventional IL-2 treatment. We can combine checkpoint blockade strategies to kind of broaden the number of patients that respond. And what about, is there a way we can identify patients prior to therapy? Is there anything that we can do to select our patients? Well, I keep coming back to this idea of antigens, okay? So antigens are, you know, they're the, that's what the T-cell is going to respond to. That's the peptide that the T-cell will respond to. Is there anything unique about the tumor antigens that can be targeted by T-cells? So T-cells, again, a very small percentage of them will respond to tumor antigens presented by dendritic cells. And obviously, tumor cells that don't present the antigen won't be affecting the tumor microenvironment. There's two classes of antigens that we normally think of. So a normal cell is going to present self-antigens. And when we have responses against self-antigens, we have autoimmunity. Okay, so normally we don't have a response against the self-antigen. A tumor cell will present self-antigens as well, but let's not focus on that. They'll present what are called tumor-associated antigens. So they're present in very restricted fashion on some normal cells, but expressed at much higher levels on tumor cells. And they'll also express, in some instances, what are called neoantigens. So the tumor-associated antigens, they're increased in tumors, okay? There's also shared expression in different tumor types and individuals. And we think of these antigens as being something we could target on a broad scale. You know, we can have a vaccine strategy against NY-ESO-1. I don't know why that happened. You know, or different tumor-associated antigens that are expressed in broad tumor types. Neoantigens, they're different. They arise from mutations in the tumor microenvironment. So they're unique normally to individuals. They're rarely shared in different patients or tumor types. But the importance here is that they're much more likely to be immunogenic because our bodies haven't seen them before. So if there's no expression of them on normal tissues and they weren't there during our development, there's also been no thymic selection negative selection of T cells that were specific against them. So this is a really hot area of research right now in terms of how we can generate responses against neoantigens because they're more restricted in terms of expression and likely more immunogenic. So this is hot off the presses. This is Science last week. Chris, did you see this paper? It's not Carl June. This was it's Swanton and Quezada, UK. So this paper looked at neoantigen expression using the TCGA. Okay, and they identified patients that had high levels of neoantigen expression. Okay. And patients that had low levels of neoantigen expression. And you could group them, these patients received PD-1, you can group them based on neoantigen expression. And this was their cutoff right here. Okay? In terms of, and there's two variables here, so I'm sorry, it's a little confusing. But, you know, in terms of the tumor microenvironment, what often happens is antigen expression will be heterogeneous and expressed in one region but not in another. Second time that happened, I didn't touch the button. But not in another. So what they did, they were clever. They looked at multiple regions in these tumors and identified whether the neoantigen was homogeneously expressed or heterogeneously expressed. So these red regions represent heterogeneous expression. Okay, and this was kind of their cutoff for neoantigen expression. So most of the patients that had a clinical benefit had high levels of neoantigen expression, and very low levels of heterogeneous neoantigen expression, meaning high levels of neoantigens and most of the tumor expressed it. Does that make sense? So you have targets that are immunogenic, they're unique, and the tumor is consistently expressing them in the microenvironments that they're analyzing. And they also, a marker of responsiveness to PD-1 is PD-L1 expression. So they also did some staining for PD-L1 on these patient samples, and they saw that the patients that had higher levels of neoantigen expression and were also the patients that had clinical benefit from response also tended to have higher levels of PD-L1 expression. So it's all correlative, but it's showing that these things are kind of going together, these ideas that a stable target PD-L1 expression is something that can be targeted with a immunotherapy, a checkpoint blockade strategy. If we break it apart one step further, we can see that the patients that have higher levels of neoantigen expression, they also have longer progression-free survival. So again, how could we improve upon the response rate? We could combine immune-based treatments, IL-2, the intralymphatic injection that Dr. Schwab and Dr. Ernst performed at Dartmouth. We could attack multiple targets using anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1, PD-L1. And what can we do to identify responding patients to treatment? One thing that we can do that is really exciting right now is we could potentially query the tumor microenvironment for neoantigen expression and how stable it is to kind of get an idea of whether or not patients will respond to these therapies. That's my last slide. So I kind of went quickly there. I mean, for me, that's even quick. So you guys have any questions while I'm here? Okay. Hi, good afternoon. So I'm just curious, how many of you here are going to academia after you're done with your master's or your PhD? And how many of you here are going into industry? For industry, can I get a show of hands? So not many of you. How many people here are interested in translational research, getting things that you do on the lab benchtop into the clinic? Okay, yeah, so quite a few of you total. So today I'd like to introduce you to GMP, stands for Good Manufacturing Practices. And it's the idea that you can take something from the lab benchtop into the clinic and the steps that you have to take to actually do that. Now, Jason touched upon the preclinical or the basic research aspect of doing this. And when you look at discovery to going into market, there's a technology transfer portion of this, as well as process development and clinical trials. And so the way that this is going to be broken down is I'm going to introduce you to concepts. So if you ever go for an interview or if you want to do a clinical trial of your own, you have to understand these concepts. And this is just a 10,000-foot view. And the way that this is going to be set up is the first half is going to be an introduction. The second half is a case study of a clinical trial that I was a part of. And it was a pivotal study where it was the first stem cell gene therapy trial in the U.S. to actually cure a patient. And a lot of the lessons there can be translated to the engineered T cell receptor area, chimeric antigen receptor, and other stem cell as well as somatic cell gene therapies. So Dr. Mihuch described the dendritic cell vaccine. And at Roswell Park, we had a DC vaccine to all solid tumors, and NY-ESO was the antigen. And the way that we did this is in parallel, we had to do the preclinical work, do the translational or the scale-up, meaning that if you do something at the lab benchtop, it eventually has to be scaled up. So things that you do in your lab bench, you probably can't take into the clinic. You're using FBS, you can't do that. You're doing things in small quantities, that's not useful. And it's just like cooking. When you cook for one person versus 100 people, you can't just multiply the ingredients and expect to get the same thing. So we had to develop a process to scale up the DC vaccine so that we can get enough vaccine for the patient. Now, how do we do this, and what laws and regulations did we have to comply with? There's something called good manufacturing practices, and this is regulated by the FDA. So in terms of, and just listen, I'll actually give you guys my question at the very end of this talk. So pay attention to how, it's an essay question, but just keep an open mind as to how we thought through these problems. Now, good manufacturing practices. It came about because in the 1900s, 1906, the meatpacking industry, and this book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, they found that there was feces, rats, and even human parts in the meat that was given to people. And this caused an uproar with the public, so government acted, and they put these regulations in place. Pure Food and Drug Act and the 1978 Good Manufacturing Practices for Drug and Devices Regulations. So this is actually law. If you don't follow these, you can go to jail when producing a drug product. So making meat and making your Tylenol or engineered T cells or dendritic cells all follow these regulations. And these are just for the facilities. When it actually comes to the drug products such as blood versus a drug substance, it actually does go further into different regulations. So GMPs, the history, they are developed out of a need for consistent methods to develop and manufacture drugs, devices, and food in the U.S. GMP regulations are promulgated and enforced by the FDA and primarily housed within the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. GMPs are based on industry best practices that continually evolve as science, technology, and manufacturing techniques change. They're commonly referred to as current. That's where the C comes from, good manufacturing practices. Now, these are just some of the regulations. As I mentioned, 210.211, that specifically talks about the facilities. But if you're using a computerized system, you have to comply with 21 CFR Part 11. If you're talking about blood components, you have to comply with 21 CFR Part 600. And in terms of quality systems, this is also very important. If you want to do clinical research, translational research, clinical trials, even if you're manufacturing a medical device or working in a clinical laboratory, and I'll discuss a little bit of that a little bit later. So the way that these regulations are written, they're very general. And here's an example. Any such building shall have adequate space for the orderly placement of equipment and materials to prevent. That's not very specific as to how you do it. So in terms of GMP, in terms of, and this is all under the umbrella of regulatory science, because you're making a drug substance, that's where the art comes in as to how do you comply with these regulations. So why are these regulations so open? And the benefit is that manufacturers and researchers are able to interpret and apply the regulations in ways that may work best for their unique situations. Again, if you're working with meat versus if you're working with a drug product or drug substance, you have to tailor it to what you're doing. The risk, though, is the flexibility may lead to confusion during the interpretation of the regulation and misapplied control mechanisms. Now, this is from the FDA. In terms of cGMP composite elements, GMP regulations cover the following areas: documentation, validation, facilities, equipment, personnel, training, SOP, which stands for standard operating procedures, error management, labeling, auditing, process control. It's the cell therapy, which is what Jason and I do. Products fall under cGMP for finished pharmaceuticals. There's general provisions, organization, and personnel, and I spoke about this earlier. Now, the way that these regulations are set up, there's actually several phases of a clinical trial. It doesn't show here phase 1 through 4, and 4 is not shown. That's post-market studies following an NDA or BLA. NDA is a new drug application. BLA is biological license application. So as you can see, in terms of the discovery phase, you can do what you're currently doing in the laboratory. But once you start going into phase 1, it's a little bit higher in terms of the hurdle for cGMP development activities as well as safety information. Sorry, development activities and cGMP. And once you go to phase 2, and I should mention that phase 1 is generally for safety, phase 2 studies are for efficacy. Phase 3 is a large study, and I'll talk about this later, looking at comparing to standard of care. And then once you pass these phases, you can apply for a new drug application or a BLA. So one of the things that you should be familiar with is QC, quality control, and quality assurance. And this is straight from the FDA guidance for industry. Current industry practice generally divides the responsibilities of the quality control unit as defined in the cGMP regulations between quality control and quality assurance functions. Now, quality control usually involves assessing the suitability of incoming components, containers, closures, labeling, in-process materials, and the finished products, evaluating the performance of the manufacturing process to ensure adherence to proper specifications and limits, determining the acceptability of each batch for release, and QA primarily involves review and approval of all procedures related to production and maintenance, review of associated records, auditing and performing, evaluating trend analysis. And here's a little bit more. You can read that on your own later. Now, when you look at GMP operations, and you don't have to memorize this, I put this all on one page. That way you can look at standard operating procedures. There's a component for staffing, training, and competency, cleaning procedures, environmental monitoring, supply management, facility equipment, quality, product manufacturing, product administration, release, and release. So as you can see, it's very complex, and that's why when you go to a company that's doing translational research or that's actually making drug products, these are all the things that you have to be familiar with. So I spoke a little bit about the clinical trial phases. Phase 1, they're for safety, are used to show that a new treatment is safe for a small group of people. So for our cell therapy trials, we generally treat about 20 to 30 patients, but it could be as small as 6. Phase 2 clinical trials provide more information about the safety of the new treatment and how well it works to treat cancer. And phase 3 clinical trials compare the new treatment with standard treatment in a large group of people. So normally phase 3 and some phase 2s are multi-center trials, meaning that you'll have a sponsor as the group or the institute that takes responsibility. And then they actually control the manufacturing and administration of all the multiple sites. We currently have a multi-center phase 2 and a phase 3 trial going on in the Center for Immunotherapy. And these are all immunotherapy, either using, for the phase 2, we're actually doing the Juno trial. That's the engineered T-cell receptor for leukemia. And for the phase 3, we're working with Bellicum. So, again, I mentioned that for each phases of the clinical trial, you have to apply for something called an IND. That's an investigational new drug application. And now within the IND, as researchers, as scientists, what we're responsible for and what we mainly control is the chemistry, manufacturing, and control. And that's called the CMC section. So that encompasses product manufacturing and characterization information. So general product type, derivation, procurement, that's the starting material. So for example, for us, we always start with an apheresis product. Product manufacturing and characterization. Because it's your own cells or donor cell, you have to do, in case of an allo, meaning a donor, you have to do infectious disease testing. And you also have to make sure that when you're manufacturing these drug products, that you have processes in place that prevents cross-contamination. You also have to look at donor suitability for allos, of course, and that's under GTP, or good tissue practices. Medical history, list of tests, quarantine if positive result, process if product with positive result to be infused, and the actual manufacturing or cell processing, description of processing methods, flow diagram, outlining processing and testing, and even the reagents that you use. And in fact, earlier I showed you the different phases of the clinical trial and how it's stepped. And for phase one, the FDA actually allows you to use research products to manufacture a cell. And they understand the cost, and they understand that you might not have all the facilities. So full GMP isn't required for phase one. But by phase two, you definitely have to be. Product testing, and these are pretty standard. You have to do microbiological testing, sterility testing, mycoplasma testing, Gram stain. And you also have to determine identity, labeling, segregation, and test methods, ensuring that it doesn't get infused into the wrong person. Product testing, again, you have to look at purity, potency, and this is called SQIPs, makeup of final suspension, potency is analysis, and generally we do that by flow cytometry. An additional testing for every cell product that we manufacture is the viability cell dose, which I'll talk about later when I talk about the gene therapy trial. And you always have to retain an aliquot for future testing in case something happens to the patient. And the other thing that's really important for an IND is the product release criteria testing, and that's in the form of a C of A. And really that tells you that you're manufacturing a drug product that can be infused into a patient and it meets all the requisite testing requirements. And product stability, that's actually not required until phase three of a clinical trial, but when you meet with the FDA, they always ask if you have a plan in phase one or phase two. But by phase three, you definitely should have a plan in place and be performing it. Product tracking, labeling, and container closures, and also environmental impact and validation and qualification of the process rounds out the CMC section. Now, if you'd like to do a clinical trial, there's actually an approval. This is Roswell's approval process for phase one. As you can see, it's not easy. It has to go through several approval processes, such as the SRC, IRB. And in fact, if you're using a gene therapy product, you have to go to Washington, D.C., and you have to present in front of the Recombinant Advisory Committee. And they specifically will ask you how you're using your product. And if they approve your product, that has to accompany your IND for eventual submission to the FDA. So that was, you know, death by PowerPoint, unfortunately. But now we're going to get into some science. So I think this is important. I know this is a cancer class, and you probably all know what SCID is, severe combined immune deficiency. You probably all worked with SCID mice at one point or another, or will in the future. But patients actually have this as well. And this was called bubble boy disease. And there's a Jake Gyllenhaal movie, and if people watch Seinfeld, that was also in that episode. And there's different forms of ADA SCID, or SCID in general. Now, it's an autosomal recessive. The incidence is probably closer to 1 in 100,000 birth, and it's present at infancy with recurrent opportunistic infections, failure to thrive, panlymphopenia, absent of cellular and humoral immunity. So ADA, adenosine deaminase, basically catalyzes deoxyadenosine to deoxyinosine, and if you don't have the ADA gene, it actually, you get a buildup of deoxyadenosine, deoxyadenosine, yes. And that's toxic to the cells. And that's why you don't get an immune response. So these patients are SCIDs. So to cure them, we did a study back in 2003 where we took a retroviral vector, and you don't have to know about vectorology. We took out everything that made it bad, and what we did is we put the ADA gene within the retroviral vector. Once we took this retrovirus, we mixed it with CD34 positive cells, which are stem cells, or hematopoietic stem cells. And then once we put that back, we put it into the patient, and hopefully it would thrive and they get low, their deoxyadenosine levels would decrease, their gene marking would increase. And there is a off-the-shelf or enzyme replacement therapy. It's called PEG-ADA. This is actually a bovine ADA, and it's pegylated to normally ADA is in your system for a couple days, but when you pegylate it, it actually lasts for about a week. And the cost of this is about $200,000 to $400,000 per year for these patients. And there is a study by Cohn and Chen that shows that after 10 years or so, the effect of the enzyme replacement drastically decreases. So after a while, even the PEG-ADA doesn't work. So why SCID is a good candidate disease to be used for gene transfer? It's a monogenic disease. It's believed that a small number of corrected HSCs can be curative. And therefore, even if only a small number of cells receive the therapeutic gene, the patient may derive some benefit. So again, this is the hematopoietic stem cells, can become any part of the hematopoietia. And you have these long-term stem cells, which are thought to be the true stem cells, these short-term and multipotent progenitors. So with the long-term, you get asymmetric division. So it's basically in your system forever. But these other multipotent progenitors, for example, these multipotent progenitors will differentiate. I'm actually from Los Angeles. This is the LA version of a stem cell. I guess it wasn't that funny. So when you talk about hematopoietic stem cells, and again, we're talking about scale-up, how do you get something that you developed and were doing in six well plates and you're putting into mice, and how do you scale up for patient use? And I'm not going to talk about all the experiments that we did to actually do that, but I just want you to be familiar with the term of scale-up. And that'll help you answer the question that I have at the end. So something happened in 2001. Alain Fischer, there's a group in France that was doing X-linked SCID. So that was a defect in the, so it's X-linked SCID. So what happened was it was a common gamma chain that they put in. Instead of ADA, they put in the common gamma chain. And what happened is that with their virus, which was an oncoretrovirus, they mixed with the stem cells, they put it into the patient, and for 3 years, it was working. These patients were cured. And in fact, they've actually done more since, but these 11 patients they published, after 3 to 3.5 years, three of them got leukemia. So why did that happen? And the reason why, and this is important for the engineered T-cell receptors and chimeric antigen receptor work that we're doing here at Roswell, is this virus actually integrated near the LMO2 gene, and that's involved in stem cell self-renewal and cell division. So once it integrated near the LMO2 gene, it activated it, the promoter activated it, and that way it was constantly on. And so because of that, these kids were getting leukemia. So you could see how important this was, and because of this trial in France, they stopped all clinical trials worldwide, definitely in the U.S. I'm not sure about worldwide, but they definitely stopped all trials in the U.S. By this point, we had treated several patients, and then they stopped the trial. And 3 years later, we actually tried to initiate the trial again, and I'll talk about that later. And this is just a little history of ADA deficient SCID. In the early 1990s, retroviral vectors were used to transfer a normal human ADA cDNA to T cells collected by leukapheresis. And this was done in U.S., Italy, and Japan, and that was done by the group that I was a part of in the U.S., as well as David Williams at Harvard. Later, investigators started to use progenitors from bone marrow for gene transfer. In 1993, three infants who were diagnosed in utero had gene transferred to their umbilical cord blood CD34 cells, which were reinfused when the babies were 4 days old. And this was actually done in the lab that I was a part of. So I wasn't a part of it in 1993, but I later joined the lab. But this really showed the first instance of gene marking, showing that if you put these viruses into stem cells, you can actually get these stem cells to present or transcribe and translate these viruses, and it'll stay there. So we've seen marking up to 10 years later, so it really is long-lasting, and that was very important. In all cases, T cells with normal gene were produced, but at levels too low to restore immunity. All subjects continued to receive PEG-ADA enzyme, and they didn't receive any cytoreductive conditioning. And this is important, and this was really a lesson learned for our engineered T-cell clinical trials that we're doing now. And minimal clinical benefit was seen at that point. So in 2002, a group in Milan published a paper in Science on two patients who were treated by retroviral gene therapy to their bone marrow CD34. So it was... They removed bone marrow stem cells through the iliac crest, so just using a large syringe, just pulled out the bone marrow, then used the virus and put it back into the patient, and these patients were cured. The patients were off PEG-ADA at the time, and that was thought to give it a selective advantage. And if you were to give a patient PEG-ADA, that's the enzyme replacement therapy, is thought to lose that selective advantage. And they received, and this is important, 4 mg/kg of busulfan. And that's an alkylating agent which destroys predominantly stem cells. And we actually use different agents now, but this is what we used back then. And this group has, it's actually more than this is actually a little bit old, but at that time, 15 patients, and the majority of the patients were cured, essentially. And subsequent gene therapy studies for ADA-SCID in London, as well as the U.S., have been designed similarly. So the trial that we did, so we used PEG-ADA, and we didn't include busulfan, so there is no cytoreduction. And we used two retroviral vectors with the same transgene. And there was minimal clinical benefit. There was 4 patients in the 200 series. Then in 2005, we used, no PEG-ADA. We gave, it was this time, sorry, we removed PEG-ADA. And we also gave busulfan and compared 2 retroviral vectors. And 3 were actually received benefit from this treatment. And then 2009, no PEG-ADA, busulfan, 1 retroviral vector, so we stopped using the NIH vector, they actually saw benefit as well. And this was published in 2012 Blood. So just to give you an idea, we collected bone marrow CD34 positive cells. We pre-stemmed with FLT-STEM TPO cytokine. And with a retroviral vector, you have to induce these cells to undergo cell cycle. It needs a nuclear envelope to disintegrate for it to actually integrate into the genome. You transduce with the retroviral vector and you infuse into the patient. What we did differently is we withdrew the PEG-ADA and we added busulfan. And these are the results. So, in terms of ADA activity, as you can see with the 2 series, and that's with the PEG-ADA, without busulfan, you don't really see any PEG-ADA activity, ADA activity. But when we changed the protocol, we saw ADA activity, and these patients showed benefit. And in terms of the toxic metabolite, if you look at here, deoxyadenosine, that actually decreased. So they're again showing that our therapy was actually working. And if you look at vector copy, so basically we're using a virus, and with that virus, we can actually detect how many integrations occurred within the stem cells. So we look at blood and we measure copy number. So this isn't the actual kid in the patient, but we weren't allowed to show it, so I just got something on the internet, but this gives you an idea of it was cured. So we came out with a paper in 2012, and that was actually really fast. I thought I had more. I had 40-something slides, but the takeaways that I want you to know for the test is the phases of a clinical trial, and we discussed that, knowledge that you need to prepare an IND. So we discussed INDs, so just know that there's a CMC section. Know what the different components are in general, and I'll discuss just parts of it so you understand that there is an IND involved. And also know that the IND contains a CMC section. Know the challenges of getting an IND approved by the FDA. We talked about GMPs. We talked about testing. We talked about the things, parts of the CMC section. And here's my question for the test. From the lecture, if an investigator were to make a drug in his garage where he had a biological safety cabinet and other laboratory equipment and he manufactured a drug product, and they're not complying with cGMP regulations, can the drug be legally used for human use? Now, assume that the drug product passes all tests, QC quality control testing, usually used for drug release to develop a certificate of analysis. So you guys know that you can't use it, but why? Why can't you use it? In terms of the testing, in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of the quality control, quality assurance, that's what I'm really looking for. And I might have another question specifically discussing gene therapy in terms of what were the regulatory hurdles that I discussed and for future gene therapy trials, such as chimeric antigen receptors, engineered T-cell receptors, what lessons were learned and what to watch out for when you're doing your own trials in the future. Thank you.